heaven, it's something of a problem finding a passage because so much of the New Testament is about heaven, but there are three short passages to which I direct your attention. The first is in 1 Corinthians, chapter 3 from verse 10, a passage about the rewards that Christians are going to receive in heaven. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and we read together from the 10th verse. The contrast in this passage is between the foundation, which is Christ, and the superstructure, which is what we build on Christ, our Christian lives and our Christian service. According to the commission of God given to me, like a skilled master builder, I, Paul, laid a foundation. The foundation was Christ. And another man is building upon it. Let each man take care how he builds upon the foundation of Christ. For no other foundation can anyone lay than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now, if anyone builds on the foundation, a life of service, with gold or silver or precious stones, or wood and hay and stubble, and these are all qualities of lives lived by different Christians. Some build gold, some silver, some precious stones, and some Christians only build wood, some build only hay, and some build only stubble. Each man's work will become manifest, for the day of judgment, the day of Christ, will disclose it, because it will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each has done. If the work which any man has built on the foundation survives, gold, silver, precious stones, they survive fire, then he will receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, because it's only wood or hay or stubble, then he will suffer loss, although he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. Do you not know that you are God's temple, and that God's Spirit lives in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy him, for God's temple is holy, and that temple you are. A passage on rewards. Now, in 2 Corinthians, chapter 4, a passage about the solidity of heaven. Famous words that speak about the weight of glory. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, and we read from verse 16. And just as in the previous passage, there was a tension between the foundation that was built and the superstructure that was built on the foundation, so there is a tension here between a tent and a house. And Paul says, what we live in just now was a tent. Now, a tent is not a permanent thing. You don't live in a tent all the time. It's impermanent and fleeting, doesn't last long. And so our bodies don't last very long. But Paul says, we are going to have in heaven something more solid than a tent. We are going to have a house. And the house is our resurrection body. From chapter 4 and verse 16. So we do not lose heart. For although our outer nature, our body, is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed every day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Because we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. For we know that if the earthly tent we live in, it's our body, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a resurrection body, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Here indeed we groan and long to put on our heavenly dwelling, so that by putting it on, we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, our poor mortal bodies, we sigh with anxiety. It is not that we would be unclothed, but rather that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. And he who has prepared us for this very thing, to have new bodies, is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. And so we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, this body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith and not by sight. We are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive good or evil according to what he has done in the body. And lastly, in the book of Revelation, at the 21st chapter, in pictorial terms this time, then I saw a new heaven, chapter 21 and verse 1. A new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice from the throne saying, Behold, the tabernacle, the dwelling place, the tent of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, he will tabernacle with them. They shall be his peoples, plural, and God himself shall be with them. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. The Greek says, he will wipe away each single tear from every individual eye. And you've got to imagine God up in heaven poking his finger into all the eyes and saying, now, get that tear out of here. We can't have tears in this place. And every single tear out of every individual eye is taken away by God. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for all these former things have passed away. And he who sat upon the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. And also he said, Write this, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without price from the fountain of the water of life. He who conquers shall have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the polluted, as for murderers, fornicators, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their lot shall be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Amen. And the Lord will add a blessing to the readings from his word. I want to bring to a close this series of morning messages on basic Christian teaching by thinking today about heaven. I need hardly say at the start that many people have some rather silly and rather juvenile ideas about heaven. Let me tell you four silly ideas that people have about heaven. The first silly idea is that everyone is going to go to heaven. And according to Jesus, that's nonsense. Not everyone is going to go to heaven. That's silly because it is irrational. The second silly idea is that heaven is going to be a rather uncomfortable place. Not a place you could be at home in. Rather an eerie, otherworldly, spooky kind of place. Rather like a haunted house, full of ghosts and wraiths and spectres. And that, too, is simply not true. Solid joys and lasting pleasures none but Zion's children know. The third silly idea about heaven is that when we get there, we're all going to be changed into angels. And that, too, is just nonsense. In heaven, men go on being men, and angels go on being angels. Men cannot become angels. No more than angels can become men. No more than men can become beasts. Because these are different orders of creation. And between these orders of creation, God has drawn lines and boundaries. And the boundaries cannot be crossed. Beasts cannot become men. Men cannot become angels. Angels cannot become men. And angels cannot become beasts. Of course, men sometimes behave like angels. And men, alas, sometimes behave like beasts. And some men behave like demons, who are fallen angels. But in heaven, men stay men, and angels stay angels. And the fourth silly idea about heaven is that somehow it is less worth speaking about than hell. And certainly you get the impression from some of the older Scottish sermons, and especially from some of the older religion in the Highlands, that ministers rejoiced to speak about hell. They were far more interested in everlasting punishment and the torments of the unsaved. There was a famous Puritan theologian called Shedd, S-H-E-D-D, who was very learned and solemn and wise, and he came to write his systematic theology. And when he came to the section on eternal destiny, the final destinies of men and women, he wrote 2 pages on heaven and 87 pages on hell. Surely there is something diseased in such an attitude. Because it's not an attitude you find in the Bible, and it certainly isn't an attitude you find in Jesus. In fact, both the Bible and Jesus say less about hell than they do about heaven. You see, hell in the Bible is thought of as a rather negative place. It's a hopeless place. It's a grim, sad place, rather like a rubbish dump or a waste place. But the real point of God's dealings with men is not hell, although some people choose to go to hell. And if a man or a woman is really determined to go to hell, then there's really nothing you can do about it. Some people come to church Sunday by Sunday, they hear the gospel Sunday by Sunday, Jesus is offered to them Sunday by Sunday, and they make up their minds that that's not what they want. They really are determined to go to hell. Now, if someone is as determined to go to hell as that, there really isn't much you can do about it. But that's not the point of God's dealings with men. Heaven is the point. As Moody, who once preached here in 1874, said, if you're going to speak about hell, you might at least do it with tears in your eyes. And Moody's point is well made. If you're going to speak about hell, one, speak about it seldom, and two, speak about it with tears in your eyes, but remember the real point is not hell, but heaven. And I'm sure it's not for nothing that heaven, the difference between heaven and hell in the Bible, is the difference between a hill and a hole. Heaven is thought of as a hill. Hell is thought of as a hole. Heaven is Mount Zion, the crag of David, the rocky crag of Zion. You have come to Mount Zion and to the general assembly of the firstborn. You have come to the city of David. Thither the tribes go up. The tribes of God go thither. See, heaven is a hill. It's a spacious place. There's room to breathe there with plenty of horizon. There's a view. There are vistas. There's a sky. It's an ample place. There's room to develop. But hell is just a miserable hole. A rubbish dump. A waste place of cinders and of ashes. So what does the Bible teach about heaven? Well, the problem is that you are describing the indescribable. And when you do that, when you try to describe the indescribable, you have to move into a world of pictures and imagery and symbolism. And I want to do that in 3 ways this morning. First of all, the negative pictures we have of heaven. And then the positive pictures we have of heaven. And thirdly, the moral pictures we have of heaven. And of course, it's the third one that's the most important. First of all then, heaven is described in negative terms. In terms of the things that are not there. Things we have in this world, but which are not in heaven. And especially the book of Revelation is very fond of describing heaven in negative terms. For example, it says, there was no more sea. Now, the sea in the Bible is thought of as an evil place. The Jews didn't like the sea. For them, the sea was the home of monsters. John sees monsters and dragons coming out of the sea. It was, for the Jews, a world of chaos. It was mankind in rebellion against God. That was the sea, the deep. And it was from the deep that the tyrants came, and the dictators who terrorized God's children. But in heaven, the sea has gone. There was no more sea, no more monsters, no more tyrants, no more dictators, no more persecution, no more suffering for being a Christian, no more sea. There is no more death. And because there is no death, there are no cemeteries. We're very familiar with cemeteries. Every village and town in Scotland has a cemetery. It's a standard feature because people die. No cemeteries in heaven. There is no hunger and there's no thirst. You're always satisfied. You are always full. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. There's no sickness. Nobody falls ill. There is no disease, no arthritis, no coronaries, no cerebrals, no heart attacks, no creaky bones, no lumbago, no slipped discs. And because there's no disease, there are no doctors. They would have nothing to do in heaven. There are no hospitals in heaven, no operations. There's no day and night as we know them. There's no need for artificial light as we have a need for artificial light. They need no candle, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and the nations of them that are saved shall walk in the light of it. No more sin, no unbelievers in heaven, no infidels in heaven, no liars in heaven, no timid people, no fearful, no faithless. Heaven is defined in terms of the things that are not there. Richard of Hampel, who was a poet before the time of Chaucer, puts it very well. This is what he says. I'll modernize the language. There is life without any death. There is youth without any age. There is rest without any travail. There is peace without any strife. And there is never winter in that country. There is wisdom without folly. There is honesty without villainy. And yet the most sovereign joy of all is the sight of God's bright face, in whom rests all manner of grace. Now, you see what Richard of Hampel is saying. That the point of heaven is the sight of God's bright face. But that sight of God's bright face is possible only because all these other things have been taken away. There is no death, there's no old age, there's no travail, there's no winter, there's no folly, there's no villainy. Heaven is defined in terms of the things that are not there. This is how Billy Graham puts it. Heaven will be the perfection we have always longed for. All the things that make earth unlovely and tragic will be absent in heaven. There will be no night, no death, no disease, no sorrow, no tears, no ignorance, no disappointment, and no war. Secondly, heaven is thought of in positive terms, not just the things that are not there, but the things that are there. Paul speaks about the weight of glory. The weight of glory. This light affliction, he says, is working for us a weight of glory. And what Paul has in mind when he speaks about the weight of glory is probably the glory of the Old Testament, what is called the Shekinah glory, the glory that used to come down on the tabernacle and on the temple in the worship. The priests were ready, the Levites were ready, the people were ready, the worshippers were ready, and then the glory came down. And God was ready. He was ready for his people. He was ready to be worshipped. And that glory of God that used to come down on the temple and the tabernacle was a palpable glory. It was a sensible glory. It was a glory you could touch. You could almost see God and feel God. You could almost smell God. The place was so full of him. He was there. And that was the weight of glory. Heaven, as we often say, is going to be a solid place. It's going to be a real place, more real than this world. The colors will look nicer. The tastes will taste better. The smells will smell better. Because it is a place of weight and reality and solidity, the weight of glory. The writer to the Hebrews also thinks of heaven in these positive terms. He speaks of a rest. There remains a rest for the people of God, a rest from their labors. Actually, what it really means is, if I can retranslate it, there remains the keeping of a Sabbath for the people of God. Or better still, there remains the keeping of a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the people of God. Sabbath, Sabbatorum. A Sabbath of Sabbaths. That's what heaven is. 7 times 7 times 7 times 7 times 7. Perfect. All the way through. The keeping of a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the people of God. It's the same idea in Jesus' very famous saying, "In my Father's house are many mansions." Many mansions. And the word he uses is resting places. Or the proper word is caravanserai. Which were the little hostels and the little inns provided in the desert where the camels and the sheep and the merchants could all pull in off the main track and rest overnight in the caravanserai, old-fashioned hostelries. Jesus says, "In my Father's house are many caravanserai. There are many hotels. There are many motels. There are many resting places. In my Father's house, there remains therefore a rest for the people of God, a Sabbath of Sabbaths for the people of God." Now, of course, neither the writer to the Hebrews nor Jesus is suggesting that the rest of heaven is a soporific rest. We're not going to go to heaven to fall asleep. I do not intend to snore my way through eternity. The rest of heaven is an active rest. It's a creative rest. You see, when you sleep, you're not doing nothing. You are rebuilding your strength. The rest of heaven is a constructive rest. It's not falling asleep. Revelation says, they rest not day and night. They serve God day and night in His temple. His servants shall do Him service day and night in His temple. And certainly, if you read the pictures of heaven in the book of Revelation, you will get the notion of intense activity mingled with rest. There's busyness, and yet there is repose. You've got choruses of men singing over against choruses of angels. You've got solo voices singing up above the choruses. You've got harps resounding and organs and trumpets. You've got the cherubim singing the praise of the Lamb. Then you've got the seraphim shouting their voices against the seraphim. Antiphonal singing, choir singing against choir, antiphon, voice against voice, seraphim against seraphim. And yet all of that is not frantic or frenetic. It's an active Sabbath. It's a living, creative, constructive rest that belongs to the people of God. And as well as being the weight of glory, the Sabbath of Sabbaths, heaven is also positively described as a very grand place. Thrones everywhere. He who conquers, I will grant to him to sit with me on my throne, as I myself have conquered and sat down on my Father's throne. Do you not know that the saints shall judge the world sitting on thrones? You shall sit on thrones, said Jesus. They shall reign forever and ever, says the Bible, speaking about Christians. Not just Jesus reigning forever and ever, but Christians reigning forever and ever and ever. Christians are going to have authority and position and rule and government committed to them in the coming glory. Thrones everywhere. And not just thrones, but music. Music everywhere. Do you know John Donne's great poem, Hymn to God in My Sickness? John Donne was the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in the days of James I, James Stuart. He often used to preach to the king. And he came to be very sick. There's this lovely poem where he tells of himself being spread out on his bed like a map. And he says, my doctors come in and they look at the map and they look at the geography of my body. And they poke about the geography of my body. And it's a marvelous poem. It starts with this lovely verse which says that when Christians get to heaven, they are going to be God's music. We're not just going to sing it, we are going to be the music. Hymn to God in my sickness. Since I am coming to that holy room where with thy choir of saints forevermore I shall be made thy music. As I come, I tune the instrument here at the door. Set your life in order. I tune the instrument here at the door. And what I must do then, think here before. You see, what Dan is saying is that heaven is full of music and the instruments are people and the music is people. And down here, we should be learning to tune our lives, to be in tune with God's orchestra. Music everywhere. Thrones, Sabbaths, music, crowns, robes, jewelry. The very walls are made of jewels. And the very foundation stones, what we might consider the meanest part of the building, the bit you don't see, made of precious stones. The very pavements are made of gold. You wouldn't need to sell your granny's gold trinkets, as people have been doing this week. What madness! All those lovely things being smashed to pieces for bits of paper. You see, in a city where the pavements are made of gold, money is of no value. Negative and positive pictures of the coming glory. And lastly, heaven is defined in moral terms. In other words, there is a direct connection between this world and the next world. I wish I could get that into people's heads. I'll spend the rest of my life trying to get that into people's heads. That there is a direct connection between this world and the next world. You see, the sort of people we are now determines the sort of people we are going to be in the world to come. Character here determines what we shall be in the next world. And just as there are degrees of punishment in hell for the lost and the unsaved, there are degrees of reward and glory for Christians. You see, it is fatuous for Christians to believe that we're all drifting home to the same glory. We aren't. We are not all drifting home to the same rewards. We aren't. Some Christians will have great rewards in heaven, and some will have no reward at all. Do you know what Paul said to his son Timothy? Let no man take your crown. You can't lose your salvation. You can no more lose your salvation than you can lose Christ. You can't lose Christ once you have him. But we can lose our crown, and we can lose our reward. Paul speaks about a foundation and a superstructure. And the foundation stone is Christ. If you are Christ's, he has built this into your life. And you can't change it. Jesus Christ is immutable. He's unchangeable. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He doesn't change. The foundation doesn't change. But what Christians build on Christ changes. Gold, silver, precious stones. That's what some Christians are building. And others, wood, hay, and stubble. And of course, you can see the difference between the lifestyles, can't you? Gold and silver and precious stones are costly, and they're permanent, and they resist fire. Wood, hay, and stubble. Can all burn. That means, of course, that disobedient Christians are going to suffer loss in heaven. People who refuse the deeper challenge of the Christian life. People who refuse Christian discipleship. People who refuse to die to their comforts and their ease. People who refuse to die. They'll be saved. They'll be in heaven. But only so as by fire. I suppose the difference between the foundation stone that is Christ and the superstructure that is what we build on Christ is the difference between the book of life and the books in Revelation. You know that at the last judgment, John says, there's a book of life opened and there are also books. What's the difference between the book of life and the books? Well, the book of life is the book of the Lamb. It's the Lamb's book of life. And if your name's there, you'll be saved. You'll be in heaven. Even if you're only in by the skin of your teeth, you'll be in heaven if your name's there. But the books are books of works. Works of faith. Christian service. And we are to be judged by what is written in the books. Is your name in the Lamb's Book of Life? No humming and hawing, please. You can know. You can know. Do you have the foundation stone? The fundamental stone of Christ in your life? You have? I'm glad to hear it. What are you building on that stone? Gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, or stubble? Two last points. If you do have the foundation, and if you are building wisely, when you get to heaven, you will make two marvelous discoveries. The first is this. Mercy, look at the clock. No clocks in heaven. Forgot to say that. As well as no cemeteries and all these other things. When you get there, first of all, you'll discover that that's what you were made for. I suppose you've noticed what a frustrating life this is. You ever get frustrated? Things don't work out. Things don't come right. Your dreams don't come true. Your plans don't materialize. You look forward to a concert in Eden Court. You go to the concert. You've anticipated it. You enjoy it. It's a good concert. And on the way home you say, well, it was enjoyable, but is there nothing more? Is there not something better than that? Or you look forward to the wedding of somebody you love. You look forward the months ahead, the planning, the preparation, the gifts. It's a lovely service, it's a super reception, and the speeches are marvelous. And on your way home you say, well, you know, it was a great wedding, but at all. Well, you see, there's a real concert coming. And there's a real wedding coming. Where there's no sadness and no nostalgia. And down here, God gives us a taste of this. A taste of the joy. Like listening to music from very, very far away. Or smelling a perfume from very, very, very far away. And you get a whiff of the joy, and a whiff of the music, and a whiff of the perfume. But when you get to heaven, and according to Isaiah, you see the king in his beauty, and behold the land of far distances, you'll know that that's what God made you for. The second thing you'll discover is this. When you get to heaven, you'll discover that it will all have been worth it. Your struggles and your failures and your battles and your pains and your conflicts for Christ and all the costliness of being a living Christian today. I thank God that God has made me a Christian today. I would not want to be a Christian at any other time in human history. It's wonderful to be a Christian today, with its costliness, its bother, its inconvenience, having to give up time for Christ's sake, and give up pleasures for Christ's sake, and give up money for Christ's sake, the nuisance of being a Christian. But when we see God's face, and God's name is put in our foreheads, and God pokes his finger into every individual eye to wipe away every single tear, when that happens, suddenly we'll realize it was all worth it. I close with these words from John Donne, preached before the Earl of Carlisle at Zion House. To him who believes aright and overcomes all temptations to a wrong belief, God shall give the accomplishment of fullness, and fullness of joy, and joy rooted in glory, and glory established in eternity, and this eternity is God. To him who believes and overcomes, God shall give himself in an everlasting presence and fruition. As David said, in thy presence there is fullness of joy. At thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. Amen. May God add a blessing to the preaching of his word.